From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2014 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can be here with us this afternoon. I do want to mention at the outset of the program, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of this, as well as many of our past programs, you can catch it at the KUAR.org site or at yttshow.org. You can just click on it, and it'll take you right to the podcast of the longer versions. Our topic today is one that I'm sure probably just about every family has had some involvement with at one time or another, or you probably will. And it's a mystery to many of us, I guess, what goes on in there, but we really sure do depend on it. We're going to be talking today about the ER. And I know that if you're an older person, you might remember some programs that were on TV a long time ago that really kind of maybe didn't do a great service to it. There was, I think, Dr. Kildare and Ben Casey, and then, of course, ER, which ran for a long time. And I think you guys might have some opinions about that, but we'll get into that as we get along. I do want to introduce all my guests with you here today. Speaking from the older generation is registered nurse Deborah Armstrong. She's the director of emergency department, the CLP Nursing Services Emergency Department here at UAMS. Deborah Armstrong, glad to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And then speaking from the middle generation, Dr. Raul Supal, he's the Stanley Reed Professor and Chairman, Department of Emergency Medicine here at UAMS, and he's been the principal investigator on a number of clinical trials in emergency medicine, and additionally, he has authored 40 peer-reviewed manuscripts and numerous other publications. Dr. Supal, glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
And then speaking from the younger generation is Dr. Lee Wilbur. He's a professor and vice chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine, also at UAMS. So we're well represented with UAMS here today, aren't we? Glad to have you with us here today, Dr. Wilbur.
Thank you.
I do want to begin, as I tend to always do, with the older generation. I would like to bring our audience up to date with what the ER used to be, even way before your time. When did the ER actually become what we call the emergency room, and how did it kind of evolve in those early days?
Well, the ER certainly has evolved. In the past, you had a variety of physicians covering the ER. You could have an OB physician, you could have a family practice physician. Depending on the area, the location the hospital was in, you could have any variety of types of physician putting in time in the ER. As the trends have progressed and things have specialized, we have emergency-specific board-certified physicians, which offers more to the patient in that that is their specialty. The programs stabilize the patient, identify life threats, stem the emergency at the moment, and then we can bring the specialist in for the very specific diagnosis that we've determined is present. But the specialty of emergency medicine through the years is nothing but a benefit to the patient because of the expertise brought to the position.
Now, I'm 65 years old, and I go back pretty far, I guess, but I know there's a lot of people listening that are much older than that, but I've lived in some rather rural areas before I came to Arkansas, and one that pops into my mind when I was in high school was a very small town of about 5,000, and they did have a community hospital. Of course, I never went to that emergency room, but this is going back into the 60s. What would the emergency room of the 60s look like compared to maybe even when you started?
I think the emergency room of the 60s, you would see more a sparse ER, not the technology that we see today and that we anticipate in the future. A lot of it was hands-on, bare bones, x-rays, some lab tests. We depended on our senses, what we felt when we examined the patient, heard when we listened to the patient with our stethoscope and asking questions. And the services that you look at then, we would look at now and say were very basic. They served the purpose. We had basic x-rays. We may not have had CAT scans then. We certainly didn't have MRIs. Lab tests were very basic. These also took time to run and get results on. As things have progressed, we have greater technology, greater equipment, and we can turn around and get results anywhere from seconds to minutes. And this enables us to put the pieces of the puzzle and treat the ailment faster, especially where life threats are present.
Now, would there have been doctors present in those early ERs, or would it have been nurses, or would it have just been whoever happened to be there that day?
It would have been physicians. It was probably one physician, and again, it may have been a different specialty. There could have been a nurse if there was a rural hospital, orderlies. extra hands to help out. But again, depending on the location, if it was a rural community hospital, you probably would have had a more basic array of staff present. Getting into more metropolitan areas, you'd have probably more staff present because you would have more patients present. But again, compared to the level of care and equipment that we have today, it was still basic compared to what is offered now.
I don't remember when helicopters came into the scene, but I know that in the 60s, in this small town I'm talking about, I don't think they ever had a helicopter come in on a trauma, even if they used that word back then. If you're in a small community back in that time and something really, really bad happens, does it overpower the emergency personnel in that hospital at that time compared to now? What would they have done with something really, really bad?
Well, the challenges to save that patient's life certainly would have been there before them. Whatever resources they had, that would be what they had. As you said, helicopters weren't around then. It was ground transport or having a specialist come from somewhere else. And you did the best you could with what you had, with what your resources were, again, doing the best you can for the patient, but the outcome certainly could have been different from what the odds are today with that same presentation.
Let me move up to Dr. Rasupal in the middle generation perspective. Again, our generations are going to overlap a little bit here as we discuss this. But Dr. Supal, and you've mentioned before we went on the air that you're kind of new to the area. So where does your memory click in?
So I started my training in emergency medicine in 1997. And while the field has grown since then, it was fairly sophisticated in the 90s. And to describe a little bit further what Deb was talking about, the field of emergency medicine is fairly new. Board certification began in 1972. So it's a field that's 40 plus years old compared to the fields of medicine, surgery, anesthesia that are well over 100 years old. So as a specialty we started, we're still very young in terms of those individuals that are board certified. So before 1972, and even into the 70s and early 80s, emergency rooms were very different than what they are today. So the physicians that worked there were physicians that either couldn't work anywhere else or were towards the tail end of their career, and they would attend in the emergency department. And back then, the volumes that you saw in the emergency departments were very, very small. So for example, downtown Chicago, the ED would see couple thousand patients a year, 4,000 or 5,000 patients a year, because if you couldn't pay or you didn't have insurance, they could turn you away. And people pretty much knew that unless they were really ill or dying, don't go to the emergency department. That all changed when they realized that was a terrible health policy. And for the population they needed to serve, they should see all patients. And it wasn't until the 70s and 80s when we started seeing ED volumes increase. Now, in the last 20 years, emergency department volumes have skyrocketed so that even here in Little Rock, the UAMS ED sees roughly 60 to 65,000 patients a year. And there are some emergency departments in the country that are seeing over 250,000 patients a year. If you do the math, that's a lot of patients a day. And it's an exceptionally busy, chaotic place. So in my almost 20 years now in emergency medicine, if I date back to when I was a medical student, what we've seen continuing increases in volume of patients using emergency services, especially since a large segment of the population is uninsured. EMTALA legislation was passed, and Lee, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was passed in the 80s, 90s, which essentially was touted to be an anti-dumping policy so that if you were sick or injured and dropped off at an emergency department, they couldn't then dump you onto someone else because you couldn't pay. That was a very reasonable piece of legislation based on that. Anyone that presents to an emergency department is expected to be cared for regardless of what their illness is. So if you're severely ill or if you have a thorn in your leg, you show up to the emergency department, we are required to see those patients. That has contributed to the volume that we've had, the explosion we've had in the last couple of years. Now I think what we're seeing with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid here in the state of Arkansas, is an increase in our volumes because we don't have enough primary care. So the only outlet left is to use the emergency department for those services.
Also with Dr. Wilburn, kind of piggyback on that, the term that comes to my mind is unintended consequence. And it sounds like that the ER from those early days had a specific service that it provided. And then in the 70s and 80s, when the numbers started to come up, and then there's now legislation that's trying to change some things, but there are some unintended consequences. Has the emergency room changed so much so that we would not recognize it from, say, someone who's 70 years old who's never gone in all these years? Would they even recognize the ER now?
I don't think so. To be terribly honest, they wouldn't. Because, I mean, our specialty is relatively new, but we've evolved with the change. Something that defines our specialty is we're very flexible, very adaptable, and very malleable. I think those that are sort of driven to serve in emergency medicine are those that want to treat the most vulnerable. I mean, that's why we went into this. I mean, we wanted to go in to care for the sickest of the sick and the most vulnerable, because we're sort of that one specialty that retains a purity of medicine, meaning that we can't turn those away. And so that old original patient-doctor relationship, a nurse-patient relationship, we still preserve, mainly because we have to. So we've become very adaptable. And because of legislation, those unintended consequences were actually meant to benefit the patient, because there are great horror stories that we could tell where back before that EMTALA legislation, you could be in active labor. You could be a woman in active labor. And for instance, if you didn't have insurance, the hospital would turn you away and the ambulance would drive from hospital to hospital to try to find someone that would take you. Same with heart attack, same thing with life-threatening injuries. I think that the legislature actually made a fairly good decision by saying that is not allowable, that is not right for patient care. And so they put that legislation in place. But the pendulum has swung to a point of convenience of care. So I would say that unintended consequences, I would say that society has somewhat seen this as a convenience of care, and there's a couple different factors contributing to that. With the expansion of those that either have insurance or don't have insurance, and the lack of availability of primary care, we are known to provide comprehensive care. Now we can do almost any lab test, any radiological test, anything that you would need, and patients are quite savvy, and they realize that. Versus if they go to their primary care physician, it may be a couple weeks waiting for those exact same results that we can do in a couple of hours. And patients have gotten quite savvy and they sort of realize that. And what a lot of folks don't know outside the healthcare community is a very sort of prominent subject within emergency medicine is crowding, ED overcrowding. And so I think that person that has experienced an older emergency department where you go and maybe you go right in, well, now it's very busy and they may not understand why it's so busy. They may say, well, it's those that don't have insurance that are crowding our emergency departments. And that's actually false. When you actually look at the data on crowding, who's actually coming to the emergency department, it's those with insurance, because it's a matter of convenience. So I think that we're really seeing an evolution of who's utilizing the emergency department. Because we provide such comprehensive services, we no longer just do stabilization. We essentially do comprehensive care, which includes primary care and specialty care, and that's where the breadth of our training programs have gone. So to be a board-certified emergency physician, you're not just an emergency stabilization physician anymore. I mean, you really know the acute management of many, many diseases. And now that we're having more and more boarding issues, we're not only having to know the acute management, we're having to know some of the chronic management, because we're getting the acute exacerbations of chronic disease. And we're seeing a lot of issues with society that aren't cared for by other physicians. So it's really expanding sort of the breadth of our specialty. And so we're evolving with it.
Can I just add a comment? So just to follow up on what Lee's saying, and the other thing I think people need to understand is that emergency services are a lot more expensive and resource intensive than seeing your primary care doctor. So crowding is a tremendous issue, which is created by those that are utilizing emergency services that could, quite frankly, wait. And there are a number of trials and studies looking at crowding in the emergency department and boarding patients in the emergency department that show that it increases morbidity, mortality, increases hospital length of stay, and is overall just a really bad thing. We're attuned to this, and these are issues that every emergency department in the country has to deal with. But when you think about it, some people would be surprised that we take care of people with sore throats or the common cold. Quite frankly, a thorn in your leg is, I've seen that. You wouldn't think you'd go to the emergency department for that, but it happens. I've worked in several different places across the country. The patient populations are the same. Little Rock is the same as Indianapolis, the same as Charlotte, North Carolina, same as Denver and different parts of Florida. You were in Tampa, I think, Deb. We're all Americans, and we're fairly consistent across the board. it's an issue. It is, I think, part of the unintended consequences of what was a great idea that could have probably been better defined. And unfortunately, that has really shaped a large part of what has occurred in emergency medical care in the United States.
Let me ask a question of all three of you, but let me first start directed to you, Deborah Armstrong. Again, going back to that smaller time frame and smaller hospital and the emergence of the emergency room, when did the emergency room become an essential part of the hospital operation itself?
I think probably within the last 20 to 25 years, you've seen it really evolve as a critical part of the care of the community, of patient flow and source of admissions. In many cities, the ER is the gatekeeper to admissions in the hospital. You can see anything on the average from 30, 40, 50% of the hospital admissions coming through the ER. So as it became a more well-defined area in the hospital and more specific resources, I think the value to the hospital in general and as a source of admissions and care for the community, it became more important.
Emergency departments now are an integral component of every hospital system and every individual hospital. It's the front door for the majority of patients that utilize services at almost every hospital. So, for example, at UAMS, as I said before, we see between 60 and 65,000 patients a year. We account for 43% roughly of the hospital admissions, and we're the nexus for transfers from outside institutions that have patients that require a higher level of care. And this is not uncommon where the university center or the large city center is a critical component for those that require subspecialty care or services that are not necessarily provided in their community hospital, especially here in Arkansas, where we have a number of rural areas and rural hospitals. They may not have the dedicated staff for specific injuries and illnesses. So at UAMS and in other hospitals, You can't separate the two. The emergency department can't function without the hospital, and I would argue that the hospital could not survive without the emergency department.
Well, Dr. Wilbur, let me expand a little bit more on that, too. If you're in the emergency room dealing with so many people as the front door, are you filtering these people into the rest of the hospital for what reason?
Well, that's a great question, and I sure hope I didn't misspeak. The front door is being used. Patients are still coming to individual specialty clinics and to their appointments, and patients still get admitted through. There's profound services provided through UAMS and for all hospital systems. But we are a different door as well. I mean, there's a lot of patients that come through us, and our specialty is to discern the acute from the non-acute and to be real specialists in how to facilitate and advocate for the patient, meaning the patients may perceive that they have an emergency, irrespective of if it's a true medical emergency or not. We are the specialty to understand what's best for the patient. It may not be a medical visit, it may be a social work visit, and it may be a matter of us aligning resources to best advocate for that patient. They may need one particular specialist, they may need one particular resource from the community, and the team that we have in place, from the physicians to the nurses, the social workers, pharmacy, techs, everything else, it's not a novel concept by any means, but that team approach is what probably benefits the patients the most, rather than, let's say, an individual provider approach. Because an individual provider can't know everything and can't have all the answers, but we have all those resources there to best advocate for our patients. So I think that's probably why patients should deserve a lot of credit for utilizing our services, because despite our challenges and despite being relatively busy and having constraints on having limited resources, we have a very high standard of expectation of care. So, and we're not going to compromise on that. Despite seeing 65,000 patients, despite not having enough nurses and everything else, the patients aren't going to perceive any compromise and they're going to get exceptional care. So I think that's probably where you see somewhat of a difference.
You guys use the term of primary care, and I hear it all the time, too. And I'm wondering, let me give this back to you, Deborah Armstrong. There was a time, I guess, in years gone by where the primary care or whatever that doctor was called back then was essential to moving the patient maybe to the hospital, but not necessarily the ER. Where is the primary care physician in this equation of the ER and the hospital, and what does the primary care physicians do that are important to the ER?
Primary care physician can really act as a linchpin in inpatient-centered care. The patient deals with them out in the community, sees them for both acute and chronic conditions. The family practice or primary care can then refer them to the ER if an emergency is noted or a new condition that needs to be better evaluated and monitored, and we interact in the ER and transfer information back and forth so that the patient is at the center of this, but they have that outreach into the community for their day-to-day care or manageable flare-ups, and then we are there to be referred to or see them once they feel something has gone wrong or it's the middle of the night and a weekend, and I just don't feel right, this doesn't look right, and we transfer information back and forth in this continuum of care with the patient at the center of it, hopefully keeping a well-rounded plan of care and oversight in the patient's well-being and health.
Mm-hmm. If you've got nurses and you've got primary care physicians of all different sorts and you've got emergency room doctors who are trained in that and the various technicians that are involved, from a employment standpoint or a manpower, to use that term, where's the weak link? Who do you need the most of? Do you need more physicians? Do you need more primary care? Do you need more nurses? What does the ER need that they don't have that's the weak link? Dr. Wilbur?
That's an excellent question, and your answer is going to depend on who you ask, obviously.
okay, I'm asking you.
We need Lee Wilbers.
Well,
yeah. What we need.
Well, because if you ask someone that wears an administrator hat and is driven by the financial bottom line, you're going to get a different answer. Versus if you ask a clinician, if you ask a patient, you're going to get a different answer. So I'm going to try to wear all those hats, and my conclusive answer on that is you need more nurses, to be terribly honest. Because the true workers who actually get things done and move patients and everything else are nurses within the emergency department and within the hospital and things like that. Because when you kind of look at the roles and responsibilities of what nurses do compared to, let's say, what physicians do, there's a tremendous blend. But they're the true workers that actually get things done. If you flood a room full of doctors and you only have one nurse in there, not a whole lot's going to get done. If you have one doctor and a lot of nurses, actually a lot will get done. So my answer would be nurses. That's wearing all my hats.
Okay.
I'll add a different perspective. I'm not going to disagree with Lee that. From a specialty standpoint, I'll wear my chair hat here and advocate for the field of emergency medicine. As we've already discussed, the field is young, and our governing societies feel, as do I, that the way you staff an emergency department is with emergency trained physicians, board certified physicians that are trained in emergency medicine alongside our nursing colleagues, our techs and ancillary staff. There's a reason for that. You don't want a pathologist taking care of your heart attack because they're not trained to do it. Likewise, if you were having surgery, you wouldn't want a family medicine physician or internist performing your surgery. It makes sense. In the state of Arkansas, we have a shortage of board certified emergency physicians, and for a number of reasons, and that's not unique to the state of Arkansas. It's hard to populate rural areas and small hospitals with board certified physicians because it's difficult to get them to those areas. We may be a little more expensive than what the hospital can afford to staff those emergency departments. So my first call would be for more board certified emergency physicians if we're talking the state of Arkansas. We absolutely need our full cadre of nurses. And what Lee said is true. You put 100 doctors in a room with one nurse, nothing's getting done because we really depend on our nursing staff a ton to do the things that facilitate care for the patient. So if I had my pick, I think I would agree with Lee. It depends on what audience you're talking to and what you're looking for. There's a tremendous dearth of board-certified physicians in the state of Arkansas when it comes to emergency medicine. That's a large reason why we're here, because as you and I think many of your listeners probably know, UAMS has the only training program in emergency medicine in the state. And we produce some really fine physicians that we hope will populate Arkansas over the years and close that gap. There are other initiatives because there are places where we may never get enough board certified physicians. And so we offer things like tele-emergency medicine consultation. It's the next best thing to having a board certified physician in your emergency department. For the state, we're looking at options like that. So I guess we could add people that have specialization in certain forms of technology and communications, because they can play a significant role in how we deliver health care in the state of Arkansas for patients that are acutely ill and injured, in addition to the standard roles you may expect from nursing, physicians, technicians, and so forth.
Deborah Armstrong, with all those accolades coming to the nurse end of the ER, how has nursing changed in the ER?
Nursing has vastly changed, especially in the last 20 years. We work more collaboratively with physicians. Nurses year after year continue to pursue higher education. I work with a number of nurses who have their doctorate. So again, just like the physicians, staying at the top of your game in your field, especially with all the changes in technology, telemedicine, and all the resources we have to stay on top of that to work in this blended environment, shoulder to shoulder with our physician partners. We're very much patient advocates. We are at the bedside, taking care of the patients, relaying information back and forth to our doctors. And the patient may make situations known to us or wishes known to us that we carry back to the doctor and advocate. And you run into those situations where patients don't want to pursue certain avenues of treatment or didn't know certain avenues of treatment were there. And we're the intermediary a lot in that education, collaborating to keep the patient at the center, have the best outcome, and also inform them and abide by what they want out of this visit or this event, whether it's an illness that can be taken care of and cured, whether it's a chronic illness they're now faced with, or something with that might not have the greatest outcome. What can we do to keep the patient at the center of this care plan and make it okay for what they wish?
Let me take the discussion into a little bit different area as it impacts the ER, and that is the EMT and the group of people out in the field who go and to the scene of these terrible things. How has that group of people impacted the ER? Does it relieve the ER, or does it? What does it do to the ER from that standpoint, Dr. Wilbur?
That's actually a great window into sort of past, present, and future, is what has happened kind of with pre-hospital adaptation and development. Back in the day, and not so long ago to be terribly honest, EMTs and paramedics for that matter essentially picked up patients and brought them to the hospital. There wasn't a whole lot of care delivered in the pre-hospital setting. We've learned a lot from trauma management and emergency department care, fortunately or unfortunately, from the military. And I think that's where we get a lot of our sort of innovations is from battlefield medicine. And if we delay treatment for certain life-threatening injuries to bring them to the hospital, patients suffer worse outcomes. So to take the vision of medical care into the pre-hospital setting and empowering these individuals and training these individuals to do more and more care before they get to the hospital actually improves outcomes. So back in the day when they used to just deliver patients and delay care until they got to the hospital, in a sense, harmed folks, but they didn't know that until the military taught us to say, we need to put forward teams and we needed to deliver as much care as we possibly can. That's where we started to learn about damage control surgery and hemorrhage control and things of that sort. So we learned that we're actually doing a lot more and we're improving patient outcomes. And then when you actually look at the future, where is pre-hospital going? It's going into more paramedicine. So that's somewhat of a new term where paramedics and EMTs are actually empowered to go in and do assessments on, let's say, homebound individuals, where they can actually do an assessment on a patient. They can actually do community type outreach and public health type outreach to the patients that they're called upon. And so it's somewhat of an extension of the healthcare community where we can use pre-hospital. So it's a real emerging field within the pre-hospital field in a sense. So it's really pretty exciting. There's been some preliminary data to say that that decreases ED utilization. Paramedic crew responds and they assess the patient to maybe not need services, and that you actually give them the ability to link them to the primary care physician, or they call the primary care physician or something like that. That patient can stay home, not utilize the emergency department, which, as Dr. Sapal said, is very costly in a sense. Then that actually keeps them at home and is ultimately better for the patient. So pre-hospital is a great example of where our specialty has really gone and the evolution of where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll give you some great examples. Things that occur now with EMS services compared to in the past. If you were suffering from a heart attack, the time it takes for us to get you to a catheterization suite to open that heart vessel to minimize damage to your heart is critical. Time is muscle for the heart. Now, when our paramedic crews pick you up, they can get a heart tracing and send it to us before they arrive at our doors so that we can get the team mobilized. We know what's happening well before you arrive to get you to the catheterization suite as soon as possible. We also do this for strokes. So we are a designated stroke center, and if we have a patient that exhibits stroke-like symptoms that's called into us, we activate our stroke services before the patient ever arrives. That gets our CT scanner open and gets a neurologist down to the department, oftentimes well before the patient hits our doors. And again, as you can imagine, if it's time sensitive for the heart, it's time sensitive for the brain. Those two things are probably the easiest examples I can give you in, quite frankly, recent history, maybe mm-hmm. last year or two, that I think have made substantial changes in how we care for these patients, all because of pre-hospital services.
And the third would be trauma.
Well, absolutely, trauma.
MI, stroke, and trauma.
Yeah, trauma mm-hmm. care has evolved tremendously in the pre-hospital mm-hmm. system.
Well, that really is the next question I had for you guys, is what's the difference between an emergency room and a trauma center?
Every trauma center is contained within an emergency department, but not every emergency department is a trauma center, okay? So UAMS is the only level one trauma center in the state of Arkansas, but every hospital in the state of Arkansas has a trauma designation. What that means is that we can provide the highest level of service for those patients that are injured. We have 24/7 availability of every subspecialty we need to take care of your injury in the setting of acute trauma, which is why we also tend to get all of the transfer patients that require a higher level of care. So, for example, if you were at we'll use a level 3 designation hospital with a severe head injury, they're not going to have neurosurgical capabilities to take care of that patient at that hospital. They would need to come to us. That term was popularized maybe 10, 15 years ago. Probably. I think now what you're really finding is that a trauma center is, I think what people envision a trauma center be is a level 1 trauma center, one in which you have a trauma surgeon and all other available ancillary staff with board certified emergency physicians to take care of the trauma patient as soon as they hit the door.
Deborah, are there differences in nursing for trauma nursing?
Yes, it's a higher level of skill needed and competencies. You need someone that's very fast thinking, great critical thinking skills, can continue to care for their patient and notice the most subtle changes. Emergency nursing takes that into account also, but to take care of our trauma patients, there's additional education, definitely different skill set that's added on, and competencies that we work at and review every single year. Because we are a level one trauma center, we expect the most out of our staff, and we keep practice and educating each other to maintain that.
I guess the part of the conversation that people don't like to talk about, and that is the cost. You guys have kind of talked a little bit about costs. How expensive is the ER? If they have a cold, should they go to the ER from a cost standpoint?
Great question. So the short answer, if you have a cold, you probably shouldn't use emergency services. To walk in the door of any emergency department in the state of Arkansas, the facility fee is $150 minimum. It may be more. And then you are generally greeted by a nurse who will perform a triage assessment. That nurse has an emergency medicine certification. It's more skill. Again, it's a higher level of care. And the fact that we can get diagnostic studies done quickly, as Dr. Wilbur said, those tests are done and they're prioritized above and beyond patients that are admitted to the hospital and the outpatient center. So there's a cost associated with that as well. So if you present to the emergency department with bronchitis and you get, let's say you end up with a chest x-ray, you're evaluated by a nurse, you will be evaluated by a physician, that visit's costing a couple $100s. I can't give you the exact number, but it's fairly expensive versus you seeing a primary care physician, maybe under $100, somewhere in that range. It can be scales of magnitude different.
I think the tough thing is health economic discussions are really pretty complex, to be terribly honest, because a lot of folks will lump in the term cost and they will blend cost and charge. The charges in the emergency department, if I see you as a physician in the emergency department, the charge will be higher than if your primary care physician sees you for that exact same sore throat, but the cost probably does not differ a whole lot. Emergency departments and those that see a large amount of uninsured, let's say, or self-pay patients, a lot of uncompensated care, ultimately have to keep their doors open. So even county hospitals, safety net hospitals, they have to maintain their bottom line in a sense. And so if you're delivering a lot of uncompensated care, care that you know there you will not get paid for, that will actually increase the charge because that charge has to go up to sort of account for the services that are being rendered. But in a sense, the true cost, and I don't mean to really split hairs, but the true cost is not really that high. So when you really look at the health economics literature and things mm-hmm. like that, the cost of our care, so for me to provide care versus the cost of another physician to provide care, is not a lot different. The charge is significantly different because we're taking care of a lot more folks that are self-pay and uncompensated or that don't have the ability to compensate, so that changes the charge.
So which ER suffers the most from uncompensated pay? Is it the big, large one like you guys are at UAMS, or is it the smaller community hospital that does have an ER and maybe wouldn't see quite as many patients? Are they hit harder?
It's probably based on percentage, to be terribly honest. It's not necessarily based on volume. It's a percentage of uncompensated care. So if you're located in a geographic area where the patients that you're serving largely are insured, for instance, as compared to an area, geographic area, which is more typically, let's say, an inner city or an urban area, not always, but more typically there, where there's going to be a higher level of uncompensated care, that percentage of uncompensated care is going to be higher. So it's going to be a little bit harder for those hospitals in a sense. And that's where you really kind of get into this cost versus charge issues, because if there's a certain clinic, let's say it's a private clinic or a health system clinic or something like that, that is largely serving patients that are insured and things like that, they don't have to deal with a lot of this uncompensated care. And because we choose to see everyone, obviously the legislature tells us that we need to, but that's what we want to do. We want to see folks that come in our door. We don't have the ability to turn folks away, and we have to be ready for that. And we can't provide any substandard level of care just because folks don't have the ability to pay. So you're going to get the same level of care at our institution, irrespective of your ability to pay. And I think the public really needs to understand that. I think a lot of folks say, well, in the inner city or in an urban level center, I'm going to get less care because they take care of the uninsured and things like that. And that's absolutely false. They're going to get an extremely high level of care as if they were seen in any other institution within our city or within the country or something like that, because that's just our standard.
Lee and I came from Indianapolis, where we worked at a true county hospital. We saw the poorest of the poor, and that was the mission of that particular hospital. And we practiced emergency medicine there the same way we practice it here. I believe we practiced with a very high level of care for those patients that were destitute in Indianapolis. And we provide the same level of service for every patient we see here at UAMS. There's no wallet biopsy. We don't know what their insurance status is necessarily. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter. And that's the model of emergency medicine I think we've talked about here today. The government does help somewhat. There are DSH payments that you can get, disproportionate share reimbursements if you see a large number of uninsured patients at your institution. So it's a fairly complicated mathematical computation. I think certainly if you talk to hospital administrators, if they have a higher insured rate, that's always better. Again, it somewhat depends, and that's probably why healthcare is so darn complicated, because it does depend.
How closely tied are state regulations, federal regulations, federal support, state support?
I think it's tremendous. I think that the policymakers dictate a lot of what occurs at the hospital level, which obviously affects the emergency department. So Medicare, Medicaid, they're the largest payer in healthcare. That is obviously funded by the federal government. Their guidelines are adopted by commercial payers. That then dictates reimbursement structure for physicians and hospitals. That then affects our charges, our reimbursement, our collections, et cetera. So it really plays a tremendous role in what we're seeing now are some changes in healthcare finances and reimbursement, where we're talking about bundle care and episodes of care. So as an example, if you had heart failure and you got really sick from it and presented to the emergency department and required hospital admission, CMS, Centers for Medicare Medicaid Services, will pay you X amount of dollars for that episode of care. Well, whatever happens to that patient in those 30 days, let's say, you're going to get paid the same. So if you admit them five times, it doesn't change what you get reimbursed for, because it's within that episode of care. The upshot of that is it's really forced people to look at how can we improve health at home and population health. Mm-hmm. And I think these are good things. But the reality of it is some of these patients will require hospital readmission and so forth. And who then takes the brunt of that? Well, it's the hospital system. And that can be deleterious for a community as well, because if that hospital can no longer be functional from a financial standpoint, the community suffers. And I think that what we'll see over time is a balance between federal mandate and how we're able to successfully serve the communities that we do and provide high quality health care.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a great summation necessarily, but you had last asked about sort of legislative change and the power of the legislature and things like that. And they have tremendous influence, which is great. However, just like a lot of the lay public, sometimes you make assumptions about those without insurance, which are false. Sometimes you make assumptions about overcrowding, which are sometimes false. And sometimes you make assumptions and decisions about how the healthcare system works. And so when I was in Indianapolis, we sort of held a legislative session where we invited our legislature to come see the emergency department. And anecdotally, we got a lot of stories back from the legislators that said this dramatically improved my perspective, and this will improve how we sort of affect change with the healthcare laws and things like that. So the reason I bring that up is I would encourage listeners to, if you are a decision maker that influences healthcare management decisions, really at any level, or if you're a legislator or something like that, we'd invite you to come observe in the department and walk the shoes of some of our patients and understand what it's like to be a provider in the emergency department, because it's unlike really any place in the healthcare setting.
If you go to any store, or you are a retailer, or you're dealing with the public, you've got some people you really wish didn't come in. What's the person you don't want to see show up at the ER? Is there any a type of person that's coming in there that just drives you crazy?
I don't think it's as much drives you crazy. We are there, as we've said, for everyone that presents. You're assessed and given a triage level, and we will see you as quickly as we can.
Do you wish they'd stay away from the internet?
I tell you, it makes sometimes for a much better educated patient.
Yep.
Especially people with a new diagnosis or a chronic diagnosis. People can become much more educated in things to look out for, how to manage their care. They can become much more insightful into how to monitor their and manage their quality of life better. On the other side, you will see people that read about something and may come in thinking they have a dread disease or something they read about in the paper, and I have one or two of those symptoms. But it's not that common. We try and see people in as timely a manner. Do people get upset with wait times? Yes, they do. We try and explain any type of delay in care. I think overall people will tolerate and be much more accepting of waits or delays if you explain it to them. Just like if you are in a retail establishment or a restaurant, telling someone the truth or why things are happening, it can buy you a lot of understanding. People do see sometimes when their immediate care may see a delay because they will see people swarming into a trauma room, because people that are caring for them are also caring for what has now come to us as a life threat. And people are understanding of that for the most part. You're always going to have some people with unrealistic expectations in any industry, especially customer service. But for the most part, people are there seeking help. They want their mind put at ease that this is not going to change my life or take my life. Go from there. They want the education. But I think overall, things like the internet have made things better. Much more educated, understanding patients. So we're understanding with anybody that comes to the door.
Obesity, drugs, maybe alcohol. Are these areas that have impacted the ER over time that have changed, gotten worse, gotten better? Let's start with obesity.
I think we'd all agree. Obesity has changed the way we practice medicine. In a lot of instances, it makes things more challenging. So diagnostic procedures sometimes cannot be performed because of the body habitus of a patient. Our level of success with procedural interventions decreases because of obesity. And quite frankly, the disease severity oftentimes is magnified with obesity as a risk factor. We know it impacts the ability to manage diabetes, heart disease, everything from there to joint disease, arthritis, mobility, certainly an issue. It is a challenge, and it may be one of the larger health threats of this century, I would think.
No, by far.
Because it's a major contributor to bad outcomes for our patients.
Yeah, you asked about a brilliant disease process to really highlight where healthcare is successful and where we're not successful. From an educational standpoint, from a clinical delivery standpoint, and from a research standpoint, because it ultimately comes back to perspective from the standpoint of what causes obesity. I think if you interviewed a lot of folks, and the data kind of supports this, is that there are a fair amount of providers that believe it's behavioral, that patients are making a conscious choice that leads to this, versus others that are on the other side of the fence. You'd actually say, no, this is a true disease process. So if you have that perspective, if you say this is a true disease process, then we have a responsibility to do something about it. And how are we going to really move the needle on improving those health outcomes? An individual provider can't do it. And so what we know from the data is that it takes a team to really sort of improve sort of a patient's improvement from obesity. It can't just be a physician. It can't just be a nurse. It takes a nutritionist as well. It takes social work as well. It takes a whole team to sort of improve obesity. And so I think we need to sort of change how we educate folks to tell them that it's a disease. And the other disease process I tell you about is drug addiction. You asked a previous question about patients that will probably drive providers crazy. And I'm very reluctant to answer that question for the reason that it's going to be taken out of context. Every provider will give you an answer to that. However, you have to have a good explanation of context to where they're coming from. But let's talk about drug addiction. You know, what drives drug addiction? Is it truly a disease or not? For those of us that believe it's disease, we have a responsibility to be able to diagnose it and treat it. And so when you do that, you become much less cynical about those patients, because then you have to get empowered to learn more about drug addiction. You have to learn how to treat these folks with the best advocacy. So it's all based on perspective of the individual provider as well as the healthcare system. So I think the systems like UAMS that say we have a concerted effort to address health disparities within Little Rock and within Arkansas, and we actually want to sort of move that needle, we need to sort of move forward with that and change the perspective of how we educate and deliver care.
If you were to statistically analyze the ER, are you seeing more drug-related or obesity-related patients now than you did in earlier years? I'm guessing from a common sense thing, because I hear all this about obesity all the time and drugs all the time, and talking about the ER, I would think you guys would be clobbered with people who have obesity-related problems that wouldn't have been in your earlier years, Deborah, and then drug-related problems that are impacting the volume in the ER. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're right. I think that, I mean, as the population demographic has changed, a larger percentage of the population is obese, and that's reflected in the demographics of our emergency department. In terms of drug-related problems, I think so. I mean, when I was, 20 years ago, meth really wasn't a drug. You know, crack wasn't a drug. And as science has progressed, people have gotten really creative, and these guys are some of the best chemists in the world, I think. They come up with stuff that's incredible. You know, now we have synthetic marijuana, which is very dangerous. They're combining drugs. I think we've definitely seen a huge uptick in drug-related visits to the emergency department, and we've certainly seen an uptick in obesity-related, but then also just the obese patient as well, which, you know, kind of, it's a little, almost what came first, so to speak. But, you know, I will also say that obesity in children is another thing that we're probably focusing on adults, but obesity in childhood has become a growing segment of that population. And we have pediatricians every now and then will rotate with us, and we, as a team, we work together. And, you know, their whole practice of pediatrics has changed because of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
Young children that now have diseases commonly thought to be only adult diseases because they are obese. So it has certainly impacted not just emergency medicine for sure, but healthcare in general.
On the other side of that equation, I would guess, I would hope anyway, that maybe you're seeing fewer smoking-related patients coming in from, no? You're not?
No. I mean, the short answer is we're a microcosm of society. We are a sociologist's dream. Sat in our waiting room and saw our patients. Everything that you know to be true about society and every epidemic and every societal issue, norm or ill, lives in our emergency department. Because we can't select our patients necessarily. So you just sit in our emergency department for a couple hours, you're going to see society. I mean, that's essentially what it is. So everything that you're talking about from, well, this is a societal issue, is that an emergency department issue? Yeah, we're just inside the brick and mortar, and they're sort of out. It's the same thing. It's the exact same thing. Certain clinics can't say that because they're their specialty clinic that only sees a certain disease process, or they only see a certain patient population or things like that. So they don't see the window of society that we do, and that's why we're such effective change agents when it comes to our perspective, policy decisions, health system changes, and advocacy for patients, because we actually understand where the patients come from and we understand how the health system works, whereas a lot of folks can't see that entire perspective like our specialty can.
We've been talking about the emergency room here today on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. I've really enjoyed our discussion. I wish we could go on and on, but due to time constraints, we have to stop. But I do want to thank all three of my guests for being with me here today. Speaking from that older perspective has been registered nurse Deborah Armstrong. She's the director of in the emergency department, CLP Nursing Services here at UAMS. Dr. Lee Wilbur is the professor and vice chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine, also here at UAMS. And then also Dr. Raul Supal, he's the Stanley Reed Professor and Chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Supal, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome. It was, I had fun.
Dr. Wilbur, same. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad I was a young one here. It's kind of fun.
And Deborah Armstrong, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Folks, if you've enjoyed this part of our program, the half-hour version, you can catch the longer version on our website at yttshow.org or at kuar.org. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.